Welcome back to Making Waves. We start off with Michael Franti and Spearhead with Bomb the World.
Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Love just one nation. Say you're sorry. There is no other choice. God bless the people now who cannot raise their voice. We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. Flesh and burning pain. So I sing out to the masses. Stand up if you're still sane. To all of us gone crazy, I sing this one refrain. We can chase down all our enemies. Bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution, to hunger.
That was Bomb the World by Michael Franti and Spearhead. And now, here's Jav Parrish to remind us of another tragedy that we are party to and must not neglect.
The Last Throes of Iraq. This is Jav Parrish. For the past week, the news has been abuzz with the developments in the Middle East, and with good reason. But Lebanon is not the only enormous story unfolding in the Middle East. the last 2 weeks have seen the situation in Baghdad degenerate into all-out civil war. If allowed to take hold, such violence virtually guarantees not only that Iraq's current government will fail, but that Iraq itself will disintegrate as a unified nation-state. That's the story being dwarfed by Lebanon. In the first 4 days of last week, over 160 Iraqi civilians were killed by sectarian fighting in the Baghdad area alone. Sunni and Shia militias massacred civilians in each other's neighborhoods, while Iraqi and American troops stood by helplessly. By air, bus, taxi, even on foot, Iraqis are fleeing Baghdad and their country as fast as they can. The educated classes have mostly abandoned Iraq in recent months. Now, all kinds of Iraqis in large numbers are fleeing for their lives, creating an enormous refugee crisis. What are they fleeing? The Times of London reported last week that, quote, West Baghdad is no stranger to bombings and killings, but in the past few days, all restraint has vanished in an orgy of ethnic cleansing, end quote. Militias are systematically terrorizing the targeted Shia or Sunnis to leave ethnically mixed neighborhoods. Those who don't are killed. Riverbend, the young Iraqi woman whose blog Baghdad Burning has become an essential window into Iraq outside the Green Zone, writes of the current crisis, quote, life here has become unbearable because it's no longer a life like people live abroad. It's simply a matter of survival, making it from one day to the next in one piece and coping with the loss of loved ones and friends. So what is the United States doing about this American-created catastrophe? Nothing. Back here in Lotus Land, amazingly, there is no serious political discussion about what to do in Iraq. Not for the long term, nor in response to the immediate crises. Bush wants to stay the course, which is like the car plunging off the cliff while its driver, halfway down, pledges not to turn the steering wheel. Republicans mostly follow the White House and duck the topic. Democrats, with the honorable exception of John Murtha and a few others, have been just as bad. They know Americans widely consider Iraq to be a mistake and a disaster, and they'd like to reap the electoral windfall come November without any irritating distractions, such as, say, discussions about what to do now. They won't get off that easily. If it was ever an option, it isn't any longer. Events in Lebanon, as well as Baghdad, are demanding that Democrats come up with a coherent foreign policy that is more specific and nuanced than saying, me too, or they did that, not us. This is not a political game we're talking about here. It's the lives and futures of millions of people trapped by an illegal and immoral American invasion and the passions it has unleashed. The politicians of both U.S. parties who created, signed off on, and largely still endorse this catastrophe are doing what exactly about it? And if this is what they're doing about the horrific civilian carnage in Iraq, why should we trust any of them to have a constructive response to the even larger Middle East crisis, now threatening to engulf us all? From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jock Parrish.
You're listening to Making Waves. Now for this KSOW interview, a phone conversation with Diane Wilson, who was on the 17th day of fasting with a Troops Home Fast campaign in D.C.
This is Scott Burguin from KSOWLP in Cottage Grove, Oregon, and we are honored to talk again to Diane Wilson, who's involved with the Troops Home Fast in Washington, D.C. Diane's the co-founder of Code Pink and a longtime hunger striker for various causes, starting with hunger striking on a shrimp boat in Texas years ago. Hello, Diane.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay, you guys are right in the middle of day 17, is that right?
Day 17.
Not that anybody's counting.
No. I guarantee you, anybody leaves a 6 on the sign and we say, change it.
Yes, this is definitely something.
Yeah, we watch every day.
Yeah, that's right. How are you feeling?
Actually, you feel fine. It's just I think the only thing you really notice is the energy. The energy is real critical.
Mm-hmm.
I know I talked with a fella today. Matter of fact, he just joined us from California, and his name was Andreas. And another thing is your memory slips. But anyway, he's another long-term faster, and he started this one, so he's on day 17. But he's did, I think, 50 days was his longest in front of the Capitol. And he said at day 50, he felt real good. It's just, you know, He could barely lift his arm.
Right.
Weak, really weak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the one time I fasted long-term for 18 days, years and years and years ago.
Oh, wow, yeah.
The energy level starts creeping in on the edges, especially at night. You start losing the energy.
Oh, you
earlier.
You do. And every step, you measure every step. And everything you have to do, you just start trying to eliminate any excess.
Right. And so... Wow, 17 days. This is amazing. How are? What are you doing today? I hear voices in the background. Are you in some kind of a meeting or something?
We've got probably about 20 of us sitting here. We got up very early. We were chilling down here in front of Lafayette Park, in front of the White House, every day at 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. But today we changed it up because the George Bush was speaking at the NAACP convention.
Right.
And so we wanted to be there to greet him. So we got there at 9 o'clock and was wandering around all sides of that convention center trying to find out avenue that he was going to be coming through.
Uh-huh.
And so we were all there. And there was definitely Code Pink hunger fasters that greeted him. And they wouldn't let us into, I think a number of them tried to get inside. I think they had one of our big signs was, I have a dream, and it showed George Bush and behind bars. I think, believe it or not, a couple came by and one of their little kids took the sign right inside the convention center.
Oh, really?
With that. Yeah, I have a dream, and George Bush behind bars, yeah.
All right. Well, very good. Well, I know it's not cool there.
No, no, no. Well, at least it's not like it was 100 degrees, and I did not know Washington was humid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Texas certainly is, but I sure thought it was going to be a lot drier, and it is humid as a dickens.
Yes, yes. So I wonder, what kind of signs are you seeing at this point of momentum building, positive stuff that's happening in relation to the fast? And
well, I tell you what, there's a lot more talk about bringing the troops home.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because part of the women have been making the rounds in the halls of Congress. They've been in the Senate. They've been all over, and there is... believe it or not, kind of on the underbelly of it,
mm-hmm.
there's, you know, there has been actually some senators have said, we're going to bring the troops home. I mean, that's come up two or three times, and we're like, what? You know, and I don't know whether it's, you know, to coincide with the election, to make it look like they're bringing the troops home then, but nothing has really, you know, came out on the top, but there are those rumblings, and I guarantee you that we don't let the topic die. And you know, even with this new Israeli-Lebanese conflict, we keep it readily apparent. It's all connected.
Right, it is all connected, and you have to say that on the surface, anyway, you got to wonder about the Bush administration. They almost act as if they're planning to send troops into other countries.
Oh, I know it. I was like, I cannot believe it. I really do. I'm just, I have never been so amazed and bewildered in my whole life. It is what is coming out of this administration. I am just totally, it's beyond me, you know, and with all the money we're sending and all the troops and all of the havoc that's over there in Iraq, and then, you know, matter of fact, I was when I first heard about the Israeli-Lebanese conflict. There was a very savvy media person there, and I said, "What do you think is going on here?" And he says, "Well, if they start bringing up Iran, he says, you know what it's all about."
Mm-hmm.
Another pretext to nuke Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've certainly been bringing up Iran and Syria.
Yeah, they certainly have. So I just. But I know a couple of days ago there's been some major demonstration. It was matter of fact, it was pretty spontaneous, and it almost filled up three quarters of Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House. So It's been interesting, a very interesting time down here.
Right, I'll bet. And it seems like it's in the national media, you know, our wonderful national corporate media, it seems to have pushed the Iraq war to the back page.
Which
is amazing. Because
yeah, and they're saying now that, you know, the number of civilians are 100 a day.
Right.
And now I think they're finally coming out with some true numbers on the amount of the Iraqi people that have died, and I think it's anywhere between 100,000 all the way up to 200,000. And I was recently on a Fox News channel. I don't know how in the heck I got on that one. But I don't know. I was like, wow, who gave me this phone? But anyway, I mean, he was like saying 45,000 have died, you know, from the Iraqi population. I'm
right.
Like, where did you get your information?
Right. Well, that's it's unfortunately, it's only non-profit, non-governmental organizations that are doing the counting, and then they put out numbers, and that's what the government then decides to use. Because, I'll tell you that I, not that it's any big deal at this point, but I finally got off my behind, and I'm in the second day of my fast.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, bless your heart.
Well, hopefully there'll be more. Hopefully there'll be more people. And
it is. I really, you know, I was talking, like I said, I was talking to Andrea, that other faster, and he's done a lot of them. Matter of fact, he just popped off this top of his head of all these legendary. Apparently, there's a whole pile of legendary fasters out there, and he said the amazing thing about this one is that it's on a national, almost on an international scope.
Right.
Because usually it's, you know, very regional or single issue, and you know, only affects a certain thing. And this one is national. So I think that's a real important ingredient there.
Well, if we keep it up, the solid food industry lobby will be out pressuring Congress to outlaw fasting.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, it's a very trying time right now, obviously. It reminds me of, in some way, when I was a kid. Of course, I didn't understand what was going on then, but I very much remember the day of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Oh, yeah.
And the feeling at school that again, I didn't really understand what was happening, but it was very, very real.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, less people right now, unfortunately, are still paying attention, but are not paying attention, I mean. But I think that this is really a dangerous time we're in.
Oh, I think it's a critical phase we're in. I really, really do. And I think America could go one way or it could go another.
Right.
You know, it's like a path. You know, that there's like a crossroads right in front of us, and it's which path are we going to take?
Right.
And I guarantee you, I think it's up to the American people to be the little button that shoves us in the right one.
And let's hope that let's hope the Bush administration and the other, you know, others in the world that seem to be bent on solving all problems by preemption and so on are stand down before things get even worse.
That's right. That's right.
So what are your plans for the rest of the day?
Well, I had to walk about three blocks and about tuckered me out to a to an interview. I was like, Lori, I gotta start eliminating that one. But usually we stay here, especially the anchor group.
Mm-hmm.
We stay here and then we have a gathering. And today we got Russell Mockheimer. He's as corporate crime reporter, and he's gonna talk about Activism, Inc. I think it's doing grassroots activism and don't even have to mess with the national organization. It's going straight to the top.
Right.
And so that's a real interesting idea. So anyway, he's going to come and talk. Usually every day we have, you know, yesterday was Charlie Cray, former Greenpeace, and he did a topic on the war profiteers, and we had a lady the other day that talked about Islam, and so we get all different types, and we, like I said, it's very spontaneous. It's, you know, whatever comes up is, we move on it.
Right. Well, I imagine you have people just showing up unannounced.
Oh, yeah. Totally unannounced, you know, and, you know, the only thing I have is a tad of paranoia, and I'm like thinking, are they Secret Service? I'm always totally paranoid about that.
Well, you know, what are they going to find out? They're going to come in and going to report back? Yeah, they're fasting. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Gee.
I know. I'm just like,
yeah.
I get, you know, maybe that comes with fasting. You get a little tad paranoid, but anyway, so we do. We have people show up from all over the place,
Okay, well, let's wrap this up, and I just want to ask you if you have anything you want to say to folks out there here on your 17th day of the fast, and what does Diane Wilson want to share with
listeners? Well, I just want people to know it's never too late to join the hunger strike, that we need people. The more, the greater this momentum goes, the stronger of an impact that we can have to bring these troops home. And it's every person matters. It all matters.
Right. It's a good time to stand up and be counted, isn't it?
That's right.
And if I know that they're encouraging people, you can fast a day a week. You can fast longer than that. You can, even if you've, for some reason you can't fast, some people are suggesting turn your electricity off for a
whole day. That's
right.
And
certainly go to the website, troopshome.org, and see if there's some way you can plug in.
That's right. And there's always a list of things that you can do there.
Okay, well, we appreciate your good work, Diane, and the good work of Code Pink and all those that are involved. And we'll, as I've said we'll check back and keep up with this.
We'll be here. You just call us any old time.
Okay. Thank you, Diane. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye, Scott.
I was talking to Diane Wilson, co-founder of Code Pink, and she's in her 17th day of fast as part of the Troops Home Fast in Washington, D.C. There are people fasting there as well as all over this country and even around the world. You can get more information on Troops Home Fast at troopshomefast.org.
Bring them back from Iraq, cause they never should have gone there. It was wrong all along to attack. And the price we'll pay is high there. They shouldn't have to die there. Bring them back from Iraq, bring them back. Bring them back, make it soon, cause this fight is not the right one. If you make a mistake, start to pack. And the price we'll pay is high there, they shouldn't have to die there. Bring them back from Iraq, bring them back. Bring them back from Iraq, cause this war is a source of sorrow, and the reasons they gave were off track. And the price we'll pay is high there, they shouldn't have to die. Bring them back from Iraq, bring them back.
That was Bring Them Back by Mona Aboud. This is Making Waves. Now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Molly Malakar, the director of Bat Shalom, or Daughters for Peace, an Israeli feminist group who discusses the escalating violence between Israel, Lebanon, and the Palestinians, and her group's search for a just solution to the decades-long conflict. Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who assesses the congressional debate over how detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, will be tried. And activist Diane Wilson, who explains why she and thousands of others across the world are conducting a hunger strike to demand that U.S. troops be withdrawn from Iraq. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the aftermath of North Korea's provocative July 4th missile tests, South Korea, which has friendly relations with its northern communist neighbor, has suspended all shipments of humanitarian aid. According to the Washington Post, a North Korean delegation was visiting South Korea at the time of the declaration and responded by breaking off all talks with South Korea. Over the last decade, South Korea has followed a sunshine policy of engagement with North Korea. However, in mid-July, South Korea rejected any discussion regarding a 500,000-ton shipment of rice until North Korea returned to the six-party nuclear talks, which include China, Russia, South Korea, Japan, and the United States. Before the aid cutoff, South Korea provided the second highest level of economic aid to North Korea, only behind China. The United Nations Security Council recently passed a resolution condemning North Korea's missile tests. The resolution, backed by China and Russia, included no reference to North Korea being a threat to international peace and security or the possibility of military action. The six-party nuclear talks with North Korea broke down in September 2005 after the Bush administration imposed new economic sanctions against North Korea for currency counterfeiting. Hardliners in the administration also squashed a proposed meeting between Assistant Secretary of State Chris Hill and North Korean Vice Foreign Minister Kim Gai-gwan in April, designed to get the six-party talks back on track. The London-based Guardian newspaper reports a Rome court is hearing the case of human rights abuses by five Argentine military officers for killing Italian citizens during the 1970s Dirty War. The five ex-Navy officers who were not present for the trial are charged with kidnapping, torture, and murder. Prosecutors say the soldiers were part of a unit that rounded up suspected leftists and then took them to the torture center known as the Navy School of Mechanics. Three of the victims had a dual Italian-Argentine citizenship. One of the victims, Susana Pegoraro, was pregnant at the time of her abduction and gave birth to a girl before she was murdered. Like hundreds of other children born to political prisoners during the Dirty War, the girl was given to a childless military family. Human rights groups in Italy say there were hundreds of political prisoners in Argentina of Italian descent, among the 30,000 civilians killed during the military dictatorship. Massimo Carlotta, author of a book on Argentina's disappeared, has campaigned hard for the Rome trial. As Carlotta told The Guardian, the trial is about making sure that these crimes are not forgotten. The accused will never again be able to set foot outside Argentina, because they would face international justice. In the last two presidential elections, two Republican secretaries of state, Katherine Harris in 2000 and Kenneth Blackwell in 2004, played a key role in deciding the outcome. Harris and Blackwell were heavily criticized for politicizing the voting process, which is overseen by the Secretary of State's office. Allegations of malfeasance include unequal distribution of voting machines, intimidation of potential voters, and tweaking the recount process to aid the campaign of George W. Bush. According to The Nation magazine, a new crop of progressives is running for Secretary of State this fall, usually an obscure state-level office. Mark Ritchie, who ran the 2004 National Voice voter registration campaign that signed up 5 million new voters, is challenging Minnesota's Republican Secretary of State, Mary Kiffmeyer. In California, State Senator Deborah Bowen has blasted companies like Diebold for lax standards. She won the nomination for Secretary of State and the backing of progressives for recognizing that there is a risk of fraud with new computerized voting machines. In Massachusetts, John Boniface, founder of the National Voting Rights Institute, who led the fight for a recount in Ohio after the 2004 election, is mounting a primary challenge against incumbent Secretary of State Bill Galvin, a moderate Democrat. Boniface has criticized Galvin for opposing same-day voter registration and seeks to boost registration among non-English-speaking residents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
when the radical Shiite Muslim group Hezbollah attacked Israel from inside Lebanon, killing 8 Israelis and taking 2 soldiers hostage, Israel retaliated with a full-scale attack on Lebanon. Scores of civilians have been killed, and Israel has imposed a sea, land, and air blockade, which it insists it won't lift until its captured soldiers are returned. This all follows attacks by Israel against Palestinians in Gaza after Palestinian militants there raided a military post in Israel, killing 2 soldiers and taking 1 prisoner. The Palestinians said their action was in response to the economic strangulation of the Palestinian Authority since Hamas came to power in March and the increasing number of civilians killed by Israeli military actions. In the face of rising violence, there are still groups in both Israel and Palestine working for peace. One such organization is the Jerusalem Link, established in 1993 by Israeli Jewish women and Palestinian Arab women to promote political dialogue. In 2004, the groups formed the International Women's Commission, a coalition of 60 female activists and government officials, two-thirds of whom are Israelis and Palestinians. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Molly Malakar, an Israeli who is the director of Bat Shalom, or Daughters for Peace, a feminist group which participates in the Jerusalem Link and the International Women's Commission. Malakar says what brings women of diverse backgrounds together is the need to introduce gender and civil perspectives to the struggle for a just solution to the conflict, which they define as a two-state solution. She says Israel has a right to defend itself from attacks within its pre-1967 borders, but she explains that the current escalation of the conflict lies in political and military decisions that Israel made over the past year.
For a long time, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the core conflict, is not approaching any sustainable arrangement which will satisfy both sides. And I want to emphasize both sides. In the past year, there were several actions made by the Israeli government, mainly this unilateral disengagement from Gaza. And this whole concept of unilateralism, saying that Israel will decide by its own what will be the terms of any political arrangement, what will be the borders, how the Palestinian people will deal with their own lives without negotiating with them. So this mentality, which the current government hoped to continue with this conversion plan within the West Bank, expanding the Israeli settlements, doing all kind of provocations such as targeted assassinations, etc., was breeding this content. And it was very clear, and you read the civil society groups working on the ground and having constant contact with our Palestinian colleagues, know it for a while, and we have been alarming the international community to take responsibility and saying that this will end with another violent phase.
And it certainly has ended with another violent phase. So, Molly Malakar, how did the Israeli peace movement relate to Israel's unilateral actions?
One of the crises that the Israeli peace camp faced last year was how to approach this unilateral disengagement from Gaza that Sharon's government committed. Because on one hand, it was a great temptation to believe that at least settlements are being dismantled, the Israeli army is getting out of the Gaza Strip, and this is, you know, one of the things that we have been fighting for decades now. But on the other hand, and the criticism was heard last year, I admit, not by the mainstream of the peace movement, but the more, let's say, progressive, and if you want to call it the more radical groups within the peace camp, saying that it is dangerous because once it is done on unilateral basis, once the Gaza Strip is handed to nobody in a way. I mean, when you have negotiations, you have a partner on which you put responsibility when you get out of the territory. And beside that, this unilateralism was packaged so well by the Israeli government to the world, saying that this is some sort of peace action. Well, we know that from outside, the Israeli army continued to control the entire Gaza Strip. So the occupation, if you want to call it, or the oppression or the control over Gaza was not stopped ever. It was just dealt by other means from outside. And, of course, it created a huge pressure within the Gaza Strip. And then there was, of course, the rise of the Hamas government, which was another excuse for the Israeli government saying there is no partner. And this delegitimation of the democratically elected authority was another kind of pillar to this escalation.
What's your best hope for stopping the violence and getting people back to the bargaining table?
An honest broker is definitely needed. More strong voices of the more progressive international community, ceasefire, exchange of prisoners. These are the immediate ends that should be met very immediately. But soon after that, we have to make sure that the international community does not go back and leaves another vacuum. We have to make sure that the international community accompanies further political negotiations and ending the core, you know, the core reason of this conflict, which is the Israeli occupation. As an Israeli citizen, a mother to a child, raising a daughter here within Jerusalem, there's something I must add. Israel needs security. It is, you know, my right for security, but I know that my security will never be fulfilled or never be safe if the neighbor is insecure.
That was Molly Malakar of the Israeli feminist peace group Bat Shalom. For more information, visit the group's website at www.batshalom.org. The June 29th Supreme Court decision, which found that President George Bush's plan to try detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, by military commissions, violated both the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice and the Geneva Conventions, has sparked congressional debate on the legal rights these terrorist suspects should be accorded. President Bush had initially wanted to subject hundreds of detainees held at Guantanamo to proceedings that would allow the use of evidence obtained from coercive interrogation, a euphemism for torture, and limit a detainee's right to hear evidence introduced against them. White House lawyers and some Republicans in Congress are advocating that legislation should be passed to legalize the military commissions struck down by the Supreme Court. But a bipartisan group of legislators and military lawyers advocate trials for the detainees based on the Uniform Code of Military Justice that guides court-martials of U.S. soldiers. In testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing July 13th, top lawyers from the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines expressed public disagreement with the Bush administration on how terrorist suspects held at Guantanamo and elsewhere should be treated. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights that represents Guantanamo Bay detainees. He assesses the congressional debate over how detainees held at Guantanamo will be tried.
The Supreme Court decided in the recent Hamdan decision by a 5-3 vote that the military commissions that President Bush had established to try Guantanamo Bay detainees who were accused of war-related crimes was unlawful, and the court did so in two respects. First, the court held that the commissions violated the Uniform Code of Military Justice because the commissions, as created by President Bush, did a couple of things, such as exclude detainees from portions of their trial. It allowed them to be convicted based on evidence that the detainee was not allowed to see or hear. And the second thing that the court did was that it held that the commissions violated Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. These are the provisions in the Geneva Conventions that apply to all combatants, regardless of whether they're prisoners of war or not. And what these common provisions do is essentially establish a baseline, that is an international minimum of standard of care, if you will, for decency, morality, and ethics for those who are captured during times of war.
What is the next step here? It seems that the Republican majority in Congress is looking to do a quick fix here to satisfy the U.S. Supreme Court in that the court stated, I believe, that the Bush administration's method of trial for these detainees was not approved by Congress. So it seems they're just trying to dot the I's and cross the T's here without any substantial change in the White House method.
Right. Well, the process would be much, much more complicated than that, I can assure you. And in fact, legislation really is not necessary in the wake of the Hamdan decision. We have in the United States already an established system that's capable of handling these commissions for detainees, and that's the court-martial system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's fully capable of handling these sorts of trials. I'd point out, though, that even under the old system, that is the military commissions that were struck down by the Supreme Court, the Bush administration had only charged approximately 10 people out of more than 700 that have passed through Guantanamo Bay. So I don't think that additional legislation and additional litigation over this legislation would really accomplish anything in terms of Guantanamo Bay and solving the problems that we have here. It's not really clear what Congress is trying to do. It seems to me that they're having a lot of debates, not only between the Republican majority and the Democratic minority, but also within the parties about what, if anything, to do in the wake of Hamdan. You may recall that just prior to the Hamdan decision coming down, President Bush stated publicly that he was waiting for the Supreme Court to decide this case, and that once the case was decided, he wanted to close Guantanamo Bay. Well, the Supreme Court's now spoken, and President Bush certainly has the power to close the base. That seems to me to be the solution here, not additional legislation and additional litigation.
There were some hearings on Capitol Hill last week where some active duty and retired military judges and attorneys came before the committee there and told Congress that they approved of what the Supreme Court was trying to accomplish in terms of respecting the Geneva Conventions when it comes to how to judicially treat these detainees held at Guantanamo. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
Right. Well, the United States has, since the 1950s, followed the Geneva Conventions in all respects. It wasn't until this latest conflict that any American president had determined that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to our enemies in wartime. That, I think, is particularly troubling for members of the armed forces because it establishes a precedent abroad that says essentially that if the United States is not required to comply with the Geneva Conventions, neither are we, and that obviously puts American service personnel at risk themselves.
The Bush administration seems to be appealing to many people's basic instincts to say we were attacked on 9/11 and we have to use any and every means necessary to protect this country up into including violating international law. Politically speaking, I think they're trying to bank on people's blind faith that the Bush administration methods will somehow protect the United States better than adhering to international law. What's your reaction?
My reaction is the same reaction that others have had lately, which is to say that what the Bush administration is doing here really has more to do with the expansion of presidential power than it does with trying detainees. The Supreme Court held in Hamdan, though, that the president cannot establish military commissions and act beyond what Congress has authorized him to do in these cases. So there are limitations clearly on presidential power.
That was Wells Dixon, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights that represents detainees held at the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at www.ccr-ny.org. On July 4th, Code Pink Women for Peace and Gold Star Families launched a hunger strike dubbed Troops Home Fast. Organizers of the fast are demanding that all U.S. troops be withdrawn from Iraq, no permanent bases be established there, and a commitment from the U.S. to fund the reconstruction of Iraq using Iraqi workers. A group of long-term fasters, including anti-war activists Cindy Sheehan, Dick Gregory, and Daniel Ellsberg, are conducting their fast in front of the White House in the nation's capital. Organizers of the fast say that the hunger strike will continue through September 21st, International Peace Day, when activists will engage in a week of nonviolent civil disobedience against the war. Members of Congress, including Representatives Barbara Lee, Maxine Waters, Dennis Kucinich, Lynn Woolsey, and Cynthia McKinney, have expressed support for the hunger strike. In mid-July, more than 4,000 people had signed on to conduct their own solidarity fasts in the U.S. and in 22 other nations. Among the fasters at the White House is Diane Wilson, a fourth-generation Texas Gulf Coast shrimper, mother of five, and since 1989, one of the nation's most effective grassroots environmental activists. Wilson, a co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and author, has conducted seven previous hunger strikes and visited Iraq before the war. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Diane Wilson, who was in the 15th day of a water-only fast, about the power of a hunger strike and the overall objectives of the Troops Home Fast.
Well, what we're trying to do is we're going to stay on this hunger strike until there is a solid, serious plan that will start bringing the troops home. And we're looking for immediate withdrawal, and we're looking for a timetable. And, you know, I know probably some people out there think it's naive, and I know a lot of people think because I've said it's open-ended and I intend to stay there until it happens is that I'm a suicidal nut. I've been told that a few times. But, you know, the thing of it is I have seen the power of a hunger strike because it comes from a different place than your typical protest or your demonstration or your petition writing. It has a spiritual element to it, and it's very powerful, and Gandhi called it a soul power, and, you know, I've used it for 15 years. I've did it seven times, and it just seems that it puts this vortex of energy out there, and it almost, like, creates action, and you could never have ever planned that it would happen like it did, but it just happens, and I believe it creates action, and I have not the slightest doubt that it won't happen. I have no doubt.
Diane Wilson, why are you putting your life on the line to demand very dramatically with your fast withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq? What does this mean to you personally?
Well, I tell you what, I guess the best thing I ever read, it was a comment by Daniel Berrigan, who was very, very famous for his struggle during the Vietnam War and starting it and stopping it, and also, you know, how he's fought against these nuclear weapons. And he said, there's no peace because there's no peacemakers. And he said, to be a peacemaker, you have to be willing to go to that same place that people who are making these wars, you have to be willing to disrupt your life. You might have to be facing jail, and you might have to be facing death. And the thing of it is these war makers, they will certainly commit our children. They will certainly put our children's life on the line, and they will certainly put those Iraqi people's lives on the line. And if we can't be as serious about peace as they are about war, you know, I think we have to go to that place. I really do. You know, I was raised Pentecostal and all my life, and I guess some of the strongest thing I remembered, and I think I remember when I was very, very young, and it made a real strong impression on me, is that the greater love is laying down your life for your friend. And I believe we are all brothers and sisters. I absolutely believe that. You know, and even the Constitution talks about equal rights, and it's like, is it equal rights for us, and it's not equal rights for them? You know, to me, it was saying the same thing. It's not, you know, you and your brother are the same. And I just believe you have to live it. There is so much we say, and it's just talk. I mean, it's like talk. And I get so tired of the talk, and then we go out there, and all this destruction and war. And so, you know, I think you have to walk the walk, and if you believe in what you say you believe in, then you have to walk that real tough line there.
Diane, why do you oppose the Iraq war? And I would say this in the context of there are many people who say, well, the Iraq war was certainly initiated on false pretenses. There were no weapons of mass destruction. However, now that we're there, we have to complete the mission, as President Bush and his allies like to say. Why do you think we should withdraw right now when there's so much ethnic violence there on the ground and a lot of people say, hey, there's going to be a bloodbath if the U.S. troops pick up and leave?
Well, I think the latest thing they say we went over there for is democracy, and 87% of the people of Iraq wants us out. All of their officials want us out. So it's like they want us out. And all of the people, you know, the majority of the people in the United States want us out. And it's like Bush needs to listen to the American people and listen to what the Iraqi, their own government is saying, what the people are saying. They are saying get out. And I think it's time for us to get out. To me, this is a very immoral and unjust war, you know. I think it's time, it's very much time to get out and let those people settle it themselves. And I think we've helped create the Civil War, quite frankly. I really do.
That was hunger striker Diane Wilson, author of the book An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. Get more information on the hunger strike by visiting the group's website at www.troopshomefast.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Tok. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Banzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is growing and hoping for your membership and participation. www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll have, then, a special Making Waves feature in honor of the upcoming 30-year anniversary of the first civil disobedience action against the Seabrook, New Hampshire nuclear power plant. We'll bring you a Seabrook activist retrospective featuring interviews with Clamshell Alliance members. We leave you with this quote by the Dalai Lama in September 2001. If you wish to experience peace, provide peace for another. If you wish to know that you are safe, cause another to know that they are safe.